my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. Let's see. Bicycle Talk, episode number 420. Hey, 420, friend.
Oh,
to be broadcast on Wednesday, November 13th, 2024, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. We could find some way of celebrating, I'm sure. It's legal now. Anyway, welcome to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Brand Storch. If you are watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment below. Franny might be able to get back to you. Otherwise, you could just drop me a line and put your little notification down here underneath the video, or you can also send me, if you're listening to this on Audiofy, send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel, which I will update, I promise, sometime soon. I've been busy. That's what I've been. I did like that whole voting thing and all. I'm real involved with the registrar's office here in town. So, you know, I got a little sidetracked. Yeah, that's a good word. Sidetracked is a great word. Ron's rant of the week. CPR testing. And testing for the sake of testing. Boy, do I hate that. Okay, so every couple of years, I have to get recertified to be able to perform CPR in case someone who is with me, whether it be at a fitness class that I'm teaching or even on a bike ride, has a problem. I like to know how to save them if I should happen to have to do that sort of thing. So I had a CPR and first aid testing, and it's all Red Cross certified. And you need to get certified every couple of years so that, you know, you can learn all the new things and what's going on. And technique-wise, I've got it all down to a science. I'm real good with it. There's a couple things that change ever so slightly sometimes as you go from year to year. But primarily, it kind of stays the same. So, you know, doing the physical effort of the CPR test is really, really, to me, is pretty easy and pretty easy to remember and understand because I've been doing it for years. So that's not the problem. The problem is that when I first started doing CPR testing and first aid work, the exam was, I don't know, like a page, maybe a page or two long. That was it. You had to answer a bunch of questions and it was no big deal. Maybe, you know, maybe 15 or 20 questions later, you were done with it, right? Sounds good, right? This was 8 pages yesterday. 8 pages. Thank you, our legal system, for making the Red Cross over-certify us with stupid questions that aren't involved in the curriculum when you're taking the course. I hate that. So anyway, testing for the sake of testing and not for the knowledge that you need to know. That's my rant of the week. That's it. I got it. Now, I just got recertified also to become a moderator for the registrar's office. And you know what? I aced that one. That one was a piece of cake because they didn't get overly like weird with their questions. The Red Cross tends to ask questions that have 3 answers, but there's only one that's correct. And that kind of testing right there, that's what I'm ranting about. All right, I'll move on because we're here to talk about bicycles, not CPR testing. But anyway, we shall move forward. On a positive side, happy Veterans Day. Yeah, it's Veterans Day right here, right now. I am broadcasting this on the 11th, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and this will be on the 13th when it hits the radio show. But it is, as I am live right now, it is Veterans Day. So, you know, a lot of people have the day off, which is really nice. There's a lot of veterans out there, and big shout out to you, and thank you so much for your service and what you've done. You are certainly, I'm not going to get political about this. I'll leave it alone. But I wish you were taken care of better than you are. I'll leave it at that. So happy Veterans Day. And we're going to talk a little bit today when we get into the show about military use of bicycles through the ages, because I thought that would be kind of a fun little subject to play around with. In the meantime, on the positive side, here we go. Tadej Pogačar and his new contract. Yeah, we're going to talk about that one too. Oh boy. You know what? You really can make a lot of money racing a bicycle. Well, at least Tadej Pogačar can. Anyway, we'll go on to that. And another one, big one. So long to Cav. Mark Cavendish, 2024 Singapore Criterium was his last ride. Yes, it was. The coolest thing about it, and we will talk about this a little bit later on, but the coolest thing about it, if you go to the Bicycle Talk Facebook page, you'll find a link to a video, and that video will show the coolest thing, what they did for him at the end. What they did was all the riders flipped their bikes up onto their rear wheels and spun their front wheels and then separated them, and he rode his bike through this. It was like the honor guard. It was very cool. Anyway, if you get a chance to check that video out, it's really cool. It tends to be trending right now, and you see it in, you know, some of the short video flicks that are out there. But only if you're a bike geek and you've got, you know, connections in that world, so that's what it is. But if you don't have that connection, then just go to my Bicycle Talk Facebook page and you'll be able to see the honor and salute to Mark Cavendish as he has announced his retirement for real this time. I'm going to be heading to Chicago here this weekend coming up. I'm going out to see my son, which is very exciting. And I have a little piece here about the infrastructure in Chicago and what's going on there. And I'm kind of looking forward to seeing, you know, how it's all laid out and see what their bike lane network looks like. They keep improving it every year. I'm not sure that this People for Bikes article was really strong and powerful for them, but that's all right. We'll get to that. And then election news on the positive side. It's not all that bad. There are some good things that are happening here. I have the from Streets blog, I have election results edition. So we're going to talk a little bit about that too. We'll get to that a little bit later in the show, more in the show. Mechanical Minute and Ron's tips for the week. For us, you know, non-mortals, non-pro-mortals, excuse me. The pros, you know, when they're doing their winter training, they can train up to 30 hours a week. Yeah, 30 hours a week is a whole lot of time on a bicycle. But, of course, if you are being paid to professionally race your bicycle, then maybe you need to put 30 hours a week in. For those of us who are the non-pro mortals who have to juggle things like work and family and other commitments, and you could probably only really manage from 3 to 10 hours a week on the bike. I tend to range this time of year, I tend to range somewhere between 8 and 10. That's usually what it comes down to with instructions and, you know, teaching and all. But sometimes it's more like 6 to 8. So yeah. It's what it is. And it's about time on the bike. It's not about miles. Don't get caught into the mile obsession. The mile obsession will drive you nuts, and it will turn you into an overtrained madman or woman. So be real careful about that. But anyway, if you stick purely to low intensity, it's kind of a waste of your special pedaling time. Training load is a combination of volume and intensity. And if both are low, you're not going to be giving your body any significant training stimulus to adapt to, which is what I'm doing right now because I can't go hard because I've got some sort of a weird medical problem that we're trying to get to the bottom of and hopefully will. And then I'll be able to actually work out hard on my bike again and climb hills again and even climb the stairs in my house without going, ouch. Yeah, it's a long story. I will continue to try to update you on that one as we go along here because it has been truly the most frustrating year I've had on my bicycle in as long as I can remember, which would be ever. Yeah, that would be ever. So anyway,
drill down and we're going to find out what's going on.
Yeah, we're going to drill down. Yeah, drill baby drill. So we'll figure it out. And there's, you know, but anyway, as far as in intensity goes, let's see here. What da-da-da-da, is it this one? Rethinking your winter bike training. This comes from Strava. Strava just put out an article probably about a year ago, back in January or so. And they were talking about, you know, what thinking about your winter base building myths and other various things. So strict, steady winter base training can be effective for professional riders, you know, who can log 30 plus hours a week. But we're not those guys. So we're going to go back down to what the mere mortals will be able to do here. And we're just going to try to go through a few things that are really, really important for your winter and your winter training. And that is, first of all, on the list, number one, stay healthy. Yeah, that's a good one. Seems like a no-brainer, doesn't it? But yep, that's what it is. It's not just about your performance, but try to manage a high volume of training spanks for your immune system and a compromised ability to battle bugs and viruses. It's really, you know, you don't, last time thing you really need this time of year. You want to be able to take care of your immune system. A lot of people work out too hard, train too hard, and then get sick because of it. And so it's really, really important to find that balance. And that balance, I like to tell people, is not just the riding of the bicycle or training in some way over the winter, but also getting in, like, you know, a couple of yoga classes a week, something, or some sort of a stretching routine and a calming routine, which I think can be really, really good for you. I teach a couple of classes that give me that opportunity to do that sort of thing. And I think it's super important. I've also, because I teach classes really, really early in the morning, cycling classes really early in the morning, I like to get up early and just kind of mellow myself into my day. Sometimes I mellow myself into my day with my cup of coffee like I have right here, because I like my coffee. I like my coffee. It's a good thing. We will probably have a show at some time where we talk about coffee and how much coffee is too much coffee, but if we do, then I'm going to feel really guilty because I drink a lot of coffee. So I like my coffee. Coffee's good. It's a friend of mine. It's very nice. As I take a drink for you audiophiles. You know, if you want to head out onto the icy roads, you can do that sort of thing. But I'm not really a big believer in playing the danger game in the wintertime. So, I mean, if you're using your bike to commute with, get it, understand it, sure, go for it. And you want to be that gladiator that gets out there and rides in the snow and the ice and does all those things. Good for you. Those days are long behind me. I don't do that anymore. I am trying to exercise my, let's see, how do I put this? I'm trying not to say age. I'm trying to say maturity. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to exercise my maturity, and I'm trying to be more rational about the riding I would do in the winter months. Also, I just get too cold. That's what it comes down to. I just can't keep myself warm enough. I can keep my hands warm enough. I can't keep my feet warm enough. And my face gets really cold. And it's just, you know, and I know there's more and more protective gear to do that. But my feeling is, why? When I can go spend an hour in the gym and effectively get done what I need to get done. For me, that works. I know it doesn't work for everyone. I know there's people that are really, really, really into their Stravas, and they're really, really into their indoor training programs and all. And there's some great indoor training programs. It's lovely. Good for you. I I like to limit it to an hour or no more than an hour and a half on the bike at a time indoors. That's good for my mental health as well as my physical health. So what should you be doing? That really comes down to you. And, you know, Zwift is a great little program that you can get, that you can tie into, and you can do this computer-generated programming that you go out and you ride with your friends. You can even set up a ride with your friends in a time that you all get together and get on the bikes together and ride indoors virtually. I mean, they're awesome, cool, and cool programs. They totally are. And there's all sorts of efforts on there and challenges on there. And if you're looking for ways to stay motivated, that's a good way to do it. Other great way to do it, super easy. Sign up for a local class. Now, this one I am particularly opinionated on because I teach indoor cycling classes. You'll note that I have not used the word spin quite yet, and I will use the word spin because that's what originally got me involved in this, was being certified to teach spinning, because I wanted to connect with these people that were riding their bikes indoors. And why aren't you riding outside, right? Because to me, you should ride outside as much as you can. You should ride outside. So I did that as kind of a personal learning item. And so I started teaching indoor cycling. And the reason I call it indoor cycling is because I would never teach anything on an indoor bicycle that I wouldn't be doing on the outdoor bike, which means I leave my hand weights at home. Yeah, I know. If you've ever taken one of these classes and these highly aggressive, we're going to get real creative about how much work we can get done while we're riding the bicycle, and we're going to bring weights in and we're going to do push-ups on our handlebars and all that. No. Again, if I wouldn't do it outdoors, I won't do it indoors. So I tend to be a bit of a purist when it comes to that sort of thing. I do a lot of interval training. I do a lot of hard work interval training. Sometimes my workouts are more oriented towards a longer interval, and they tend to build. Sometimes I focus on, I've got simulated hill climbs that I do, which get slowly and gradually more and more difficult, kind of like it would if you were out riding your bicycle outside. Try to simulate as much indoors as I do outdoors. So anyway, that's kind of my direction to go. But no weights, no push-ups, no weird things, no handstands on the bicycle while I'm riding the bicycle indoors, no point in it, so I don't do it. So, and I know that there are people out there that just love their aerobic instructor spin workouts, but that's not me. And my classes are popular, and I have a pretty solid following. Had 8 people in class this morning. That will build over the winter time. I'll have up 12 to 15 people at most, but that's a good healthy room of athletes when you get everyone together, and everyone seems to feed off of one another. It's a nice thing. It's kind of nice. But anyway, the other thing you can do, though, that you can still ride outdoors. And like I said, I'm not real big on getting cold. But if I were able to ride outdoors in the wintertime, it would probably be on a mountain and or cyclocross and or gravel bike, because you're going a lot slower. So therefore, you don't have that cold wind problem, which is what really causes a lot of trouble with riding outdoors, because the wind can just tear you to pieces. So riding on the road in the wind can be really, really rough. Not to mention, it also has the ability, I mean, we'll get wind gusts of 30, 35 miles an hour, and it blows you around, and you got to learn how to ride with that and keep a relatively straight line. And, you know, it's complicated. Back in the days when I was racing my bicycle, it was super important for me to get those miles on the road. And I was a mile addict back then, so I was really into miles, miles, miles. But I also did spend a relatively long period of time at our local University of Connecticut skating rink. And I would do hours there. So I would go and I'd hop on my skates and I could go to an open session of up to 3 hours and just skate. And the skating was really good because it kept my heart rate relatively low. So I was doing long, slow distance training. I was building base. And I was also loading and unloading the legs with every single skate stroke. So you're using your quads, you're using your glutes, you're using a lot of muscles that you use that are on your bike. So I found it to be very useful. Cross-country skiing is another effort that you can do in the wintertime. Right now is when it's a good time. I won't say you need to, but it's a good time to sit down and figure out what your plan's going to be, because you can do a lot, and you can even walk. You can even just go outside and walk, get some fresh air. It's really nice. It's wonderful. You know, there's things you can do that aren't related to your bicycle, but will help you with your bicycle. So the other thing is off the bike work. Things like core strengthening, exercises, yoga, Pilates, maybe a little bit of, you know, weightlifting. I tend to use lighter weights because I'm not a big beefy guy, so that's not where I'm going. But I am wanting to keep things fairly tight and strong. And when I get into the gym, I like to use actually machines that don't have any weights on them at all, so I can, you know, just suspend myself and lift my legs up and put them down. And there's a number of different ways of doing it, and just by just using your own body, and that's it. And you don't have to get crazy with the super heavy weights if you don't want to, but you might want to. Remember, if you do that, you are going to gain some muscle weight, so you are going to be a little heavier by doing all of the weights. And when you get back outside and hit your first hill, you got to carry that weight up the hill. Sure, you got the strength to do it. That helps a lot. But just remember, it's strength to weight ratio is what makes hill climbing a success. So yeah, there's a balance. Once again, did I say balance earlier? I did say balance earlier. So these are things that you need to take a look at. And if you can lift weights for 2 or 3 sessions a week throughout the week, it doesn't have to be long. It can be 20 minutes. It can be a half an hour. It could be an hour if you're really into it and it helps you. The key point here is, does it help you? And if it helps you, then you want to keep doing it. That's a good thing. If it causes nothing but problems or makes you slower on your bike, or makes you in some way not effectively be able to ride your bike, then, you know, this, you might want to adjust. Or talk to somebody about it. Talk to a personal trainer about it. Talk to someone in the gym that might be able to give you some advice, because they spend a lot of time in the gym. And you can get a lot from that. So it all really comes down to what works for you in the winter for your training. So rethink your winter bike training. That's what this was all about. That's where I wanted to go. That's my tip of the week. I do have another little addition to this, and I think I still have time to go here. And it's this is also off of Strava. It's you know, this is one that we all talk about a lot. A lot of us who ride our bikes a lot, and we're concerned about maybe, you know, staying quote unquote fast on our bikes, because we don't want to lose that speed. We remember what it was like to ride fast. And as you get older, you know, you remember what it was like to ride fast. Riding fast is not something that usually goes along with the getting older thing. So you kind of slowly but surely get a little bit slower. And that's a fact of life and what it is. The most important thing is you're on your bike and you're still doing it. And you're still doing it at what? Let's see, we have Saul now. What is he, 97 years old? He's still on his bike. Think about that. 97 years old, still on his bike. Shout out to Saul Nesselroth up in Storrs, Connecticut. He's our local old guy on a bike and makes me always feel young when I know that he's 97 and I'm not. But, you know, the point being here is, yes, you can be 97 years of age and you can still ride a bicycle. It's a beautiful thing. And that's
Saul.
That's what our friend Saul does, right? There's Fran. So, you know, that's, and to me, I look at that as a goal, you know. Wow, will I still be able to do this when I get into my 80s and into my 90s? And I think the answer is yes. You just got to make sure that you have to get over some of the obstacles, or what did we call it back when I had my heart surgery? The bump in the road. Right. You got to get over the bumps in the road to keep going on down the road. So will riding slow make you fast?
Yes.
Okay, this is from Strava, and the answer is, of course, yes. That's the spoiler alert, yes. But yeah, high-intensity interval sessions get all the attention, but there are also powerful psychological adaptations that only result from going on long, slow rides. So if it's tempting to want to ride hard all the time. Fast group rides are fun, but it only takes a few high-intensity interval sessions to see significant gains. So understandably, it's understandable to want to abstain from doing any more long, slow rides, especially if the weather is cold and gray. But if all you ever do is intervals, your progress will plateau before you reach your full potential. And that's because of certain key psychological and metabolic applications that can only be developed by consistently riding slow for prolonged periods of time. You know, one of the things that I do, so, you know, here I am teaching all these high intensity interval classes, right? But I don't always go high intensity interval in the classes. I only teach the class at times. And my general way of dealing with this for myself when I'm fit and feeling good about it, I only go hard 2 days a week, and that's it. Otherwise, everything else is low intensity, and I'm simply teaching the class. Now, I have people that come into my classes, and they go hard every single time. They go every day, and that's what they do. That's their prerogative and what they do, and if it works for them and helps them, that's great. Personally, I need the time off on the legs because I do this every day, and I need a break. So endurance rides, base rides, are not filler. They're not an old-fashioned remnant of the Merckx area, otherwise known as long, slow distance for training. They're building blocks that form a foundation or base of the fitness pyramid. So they can change our physiology and metabolism to meet the demands of the sport of cycling, says physiologist Ryan Kohler of the Rocky Mountain Devo Coaching, and the former director of the University of Colorado Sports Medicine and Performance Center. They have the ability to transform a person of general ability into someone who can compete in the endurance sport. Yeah, see that? So the science is fueling the engine. The primary focus of base training is to improve our ability to perform for long periods of time at a steady, moderate pace. To do this, you have to build your oxygen-consuming slow-twitch muscle fibers, our aerobic engine, which use fat as their primary fuel source. So to do that, you have to isolate those slow-twitch muscle fibers for long periods of time, and that's where the long, slow ride comes in. This improves the body's ability to use fat as an energy during steady efforts, which has several benefits. Even the skinniest cyclist has a nearly endless supply of fat to use as fuel at the cellular level. Thus, by relying on fat as fuel, we delay the use of carbohydrate stores, which are more limited for when we need them most during attacks and sprints and other high-intensity efforts, when we utilize our fast twitch fibers. So Another adaptation takes place during long rides and improved ability to use lactate as fuel. For a time, lactate had a poor reputation among endurance athletes, but it's actually a powerful fuel source. In fact, in research, the head of performance for the UAE Cycling Emirates World Team says an athlete's ability to maintain blood lactate levels is one of the best measures of performance. So, interestingly, the fast twitch fibers produce a ton of lactate. Slow twitch fibers use it for fuel in highly trained athletes. The research indicates there are high levels of both protein that a protein that pumps lactate out of fast twitch fibers and a second related molecule which allows slow twitch fibers to absorb lactate. So, 2 hours isn't enough to be considered a long ride, especially for athletes who ride regularly. Research suggests that at least 3 hours are necessary to produce cellular changes. 3 hours indoors on a bicycle is mind-numbing. I don't know what else to tell you about it. But yeah, you gotta have a way. You have to come up with a method of which you can control that and still keep your head into the game. It's hard. Music helps, you know, put your pods in your ears. A good movie maybe would help.
A Hallmark movie this
time of year. I do not recommend reading a book while on your bicycle. I see people do it in the gym all the time. I still haven't quite figured that one out.
No, but you could listen to one. But
you could listen to a book. Absolutely. You could do a book on tape, and you could listen to a book too. So there are ways to entertain the brain while the body is doing its low intensity training. So that is a good thing. Then there comes the other part, and that is the incredible amount of pressure that is placed upon your saddle for 3 hours on your bicycle indoors. Because it's not like riding outdoors where you're riding along and all of a sudden there's a little rise and you get up out of the saddle and you charge up over the little rise just to kind of keep your momentum going. Or you get to a long hill and you end up getting out of the saddle for minutes at a time. So you do have to kind of focus on occasionally doing that, but if you're trying to ride at low intensity, you don't want to do it hard or fast. So it requires a little bit of mental discipline to be able to ride at that level. So forcing that low work level is something that takes time to perfect. But it does make a difference because it does build you over the winter. And it's a great time to do it because, you know, you're not out riding with your buddies on the group ride. You're not out getting yourself fit for the next race, or, you know, you're not doing the next cyclocross race or whatever it is. You're just trying to just take care of your body, repair your body, let it refuel itself. So it's really, really important to, again, find that, here comes that word again, balance that works best for you. And that's what you do in the wintertime. You just try to lay out a little bit of a plan, write it down, make a spreadsheet, follow it somewhat close, not super close. Do what works for your head as well as what works for your body. So that's what I got right now. Ride slow, though. Ride slow makes you fast. It does. It stores up. It really works well for you. And eventually, when you switch gears, that's a bicycle talk term, when you switch gears and you start going more to the high intensity work after you built this long base, you cut your time back dramatically as far as number of hours spent doing it, and you increase the intensity, and you get, I have to say, I'm an old timer that did a lot of long slow distance training and then raced his bike, and you get incredibly fast. It really makes a big difference. So yes, riding your bike slow can make you fast. It's all true. All right, and you'll hear me preach this forever because I'm that old curmudgeon guy. But anyway, let's move on to kind of an interesting thing here. It's Veterans Day, so I thought maybe we would talk a little bit about people who are in the military who ride bicycles. And the believe it or not, it's out there. The bicycle infantry, they're infantry soldiers who maintain, who maneuver on or more often in between battlefields using military bicycles. The term dates back from the late 19th century when safety bicycles became popular in Europe, the United States, and Australia. Historically, bicycles lessened the need for horses, fuel, and vehicle maintenance. Though their use has waned off over the years in many armies, they continue to be used in unconventional armies, such as militias. All right, so the origins go all the way back to the development of pneumatic tires, coupled with shorter, sturdier frames that were built in the late 19th century and led to the investigation of possible military uses for bikes. To some extent, bicycles took over the functions of dragoons. I don't know what a dragoon is. That's interesting. Especially as messengers and scouts, substituting for horses in warfare, bicycle units or detachments were in existence by the end of the 19th century. In most armies, the United Kingdom employed bicycle troops in the militia and territorial units rather than in regular units. Essentially, this reflected the popularity of cycling amongst the civilian population and the perceived value of bicycles in providing increased mobility for home defense units. Okay, this is all coming from Wikipedia, by the way, to give them some credit as far as, and you know Wikipedia, it can change any day and it could be someone's opinion, and you know, so you don't take it all completely as fact, but I get a fair amount of good information from Wikipedia, so here we are. In 1887, the first series of cyclist maneuvers involved British volunteer units. In France, several experimental units were created, started in 1886. They developed folding bicycles that could be collapsed and carried and slung across the backs of their riders from an early date. By 1900, the French Line Infantry and Chasseurs Battalion had a cyclist detachment intended for skirmishing, scouting, and dispatch carrying. In the years to World War I, the availability of an extensive network of paved and gravel roads in Western Europe made military cyclists appear to be a feasible alternative to horse-mounted troops on the grounds of economy, simplicity of training, relative silence when on the move, and ease of logistical support. The Dutch and the Belgian armies, with extensive flat terrain within their national boundaries, maintained a battalion or a company-sized unit of cyclists. The Italians expanded their established role as fast-moving light infantry through the extensive use of bicycles in the 1890s and onwards. Even the Swiss Army found bicycles to be a useful means of mobility in the rough terrain where horse cavalry could not be used. The Imperial Russian Gendarmerie used bicycles with outrigged wheels to mount patrols along the Siberian Highway or Railway before and during the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. So, you know, bicycles have been used for a long, long time in the military, and it's Veterans Day, so we're kind of honoring the military and bringing you back a little bit of history here to show you all the different things that have happened. World War I, cycle-mounted infantry scouts, messengers, and ambulance carriers were extensively used in all combatants. Italy used bicycles until the end of the war. The German army had a light infantry battalion, and each had a bicycle company. And at the outbreak of the war, and the additional units were raised during the war, bringing a total of 80 companies. This is World War I. So let's see, if you move on to 1937, I'm going to kind of skip through here. 1937, the invasion of China. Japan employed some 50,000 bicycle troops. early World War II, the Southern campaign through Malaya en route to capturing Singapore in 1941 was largely dependent on bicycle riding soldiers. So it's kind of interesting because, you know, although the Japanese were under orders not to embark for Malaya with bicycles there for fear of showing up in amphibious landings, they knew from the intelligence that bicycles were plentiful in Malaya and moved to systematically confiscate bicycles from the citizens and use them for their squadrons. Very interesting. The invasion of Poland in 1939, most Polish infantry divisions included a company of bicycle riding scouts. Yeah, bicycles are everywhere. I remember reading this really cool article once, and I don't know if it won't, it's probably not in here. It is not. And it was, there were, during World War II, when Adolf Hitler was obviously doing his main damage to the Jews, there were people that were escaping the country, but they needed paperwork to get themselves across borders. And of course, you know, if you couldn't carry anything like that, there was a guy, and I should find this because this was an awesome story. This guy was rolling up their papers and putting them into the tubing of his bicycle. And he was a very famous bike racer. So he just crossed borders and everybody waved to him because he was a local hero. And he just rode his bike across borders, and he was actually transporting important Jewish documents. And no one really knew he was doing it. That's kind of a cool thing. That's a great story. I'll look that up someday, and I'll tell a little bit more about that, because it's totally cool. But anyway, bicycles have been used everywhere. They're not really being used a whole lot now, but that's all right. Later uses, yeah, we had the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army use bicycles to ferry supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, avoiding the repeated attacks of the United States and Allied bombing raids. When heavily loaded with supplies, such as sacks of rice, these bicycles were seldom rideable, but they were pushed by a tender walking alongside. With especially bulky cargo, the tenders sometimes attach bamboo poles to their bikes for tiller-like steering. This method can be seen in practice in China today. Vietnamese cargo bikes were rebuilt for in jungle workshops and reinforced frames to carry heavy loads over all terrain. So, a little bit of bicycle history there with the military. Happy Veterans Day to those of you who are out there and who have served for us. We really appreciate what you have done for us. Sitting next to a gentleman and in Hartford at the UConn Women's Games, and we got talking about his time in the Air Force, and you know, they were honoring veterans the other day at the game. So, cool stuff. Let's move on because I'm running out of time here, and I got a couple more things I need to talk about. And before we go any further, we hit this. All right, let's go there. First of all, we're going to go to Mark Cavendish. He finally calls it quits. Okay, 35 Tour de France wins and a final race at the Singapore Criterium, which is where he was honored over the weekend. So. Pretty cool stuff, and he stated, quote-unquote, Sunday will be the final race of my professional cycling career. He's 39 years old, and he wrote that on Instagram in Singapore today. With journalists, Cavendish decided to answer questions on his career and the possibility of racing in 2025. He's not going to do it. He's done. He's had enough. He's going to move on to other things, as he says. Was a long career for him. He had many, many wins, and he now needs to move forward and not be the Manx missile any longer. But you know what? He was fast, and he was impressive. He was a little arrogant when he was younger, but you know, he was what he was. And so anyway, it's a big moment because he definitely got a lot of fans along the way because that man could move a bicycle, that's for sure. So Mark Cavendish, we salute you and your efforts and the entertainment that you gave us over the years in cycling, and hope you move on to bigger and better things, which we can also follow you around with. That would be really, really cool. What else did I have here? Where is it? I know it's here. Hang on. Let's go back. Okay. One more little bicycle racing thing here. Tadej Pogačar. Seems like all we talk about these days is Tadej Pogačar. Then he's like broken all sorts of records. He has put the pace up on numerous grand tours that have now broken records there. Well, he's about to break another record. Actually, I think he just did. 53 million euros contract with the UAE. $50 million euro deal with the UAE Emirates, extending his contract to 2030 and preparing for a thrilling 2025 season. Yep, he's not only solidified his place in the cycling history, but also established himself as the highest paid rider in the peloton with groundbreaking contract extension. So according to La Gazette dello Sport, as reported by Cycling News, Pogačar will earn 50 million euros over 6 years with the UAE team Emirates, plus potential bonuses and eye-popping 200 million buyout clause. Whew, wow. His salary increased to 8 million euro per year, places him ahead of rivals Remco Evenepoel, Jonas Vingegaard, and who will both earn around 5 million euros annually. So there it is. Tadej's making money racing bikes. Well, they're all making money racing bikes. Good for them. It is really dangerous. It is a really difficult sport to be involved in. The things that they put their bodies through, and then the potential crashes that could happen, they should be paying them a lot of money, because I just love to watch it. I can tell you that. I love to watch them compete. I love to watch the strategies. I love everything about bike racing. It's a really, really cool sport. So yay, Tadej, you know, making some money. Good for you. You should. That definitely is a good thing. Let's see, what else do I have here on the list of things that we need to talk about today? Last week, I started in on talking about the Tour de France and the upcoming Tour de France this year, and also the Giro d'Italia. But one of the things that popped out, it was the one of the classic climbs in the Tour de France over the years, and it gets used over and over and over again, and that's Mount Ventoux. And it's it is, if you look at pictures of Mount Ventoux, it is an absolutely barren mountaintop. There are no trees. It is above tree line. It looks like you're in the middle of a desert, except you're on top of a mountain, and it's nothing but just open winds and climbs that are not as severe as you get to the top, but still plenty of difficult climbs that happen on this. And the 2025 edition of the Tour de France will mark the 19th time that the peloton will go head on in Mount Ventoux. It's a hilly mountain with seamlessly endless slopes that weave across a barren, lifeless landscape, setting Ventoux apart from other iconic climbs to feature in the Tour. When Ventoux appeared in 2021 with a spectacular double ascent, it culminated in Wout van Aert claiming a solo victory in a nearby town. It has been the stage for a number of cyclists that have been, you know, big names in the bicycle racing world. It marked the first battle between two sports titans, Jonas Vingegaard and locking horns with Tadej Pogačar, and briefly distancing the Slovenian near the summit of the monster climb. For 2025, the organizers have reverted to a summit finish 12 years since a tour stage last culminated at the top of the mythical peak. However, Mount Ventoux is by no means the highest peak to grace the tour, nor the longest or the steepest. So why is it that Ventoux is such a thing to talk about? Are you ready? Here it is. Here's what you need to know about the Giant of Provence. All right. It is in the region of Provence in the southeast of France. Mount Ventoux is roughly 20 kilometers northeast of the town of Carpentras. While defined as being in the periphery of the Alps geographically, Ventoux is often seen as separate from the French Alps due to its isolated position. As the crow flies, Mount Ventoux lies 120 kilometers southwest of Alpe d'Huez, another one of those famous Tour de France iconic climbs. Adding to its nature, it protrudes from the surrounding lowlands, making it seem all more daunting of a challenge to ascend by bike, given its exposure to the elements. And this is where Ventoux kicks you in the butt. As early as the 12th century, the deforestation for shipbuilding helped to create the harsh landscape of gray stone. Sheep herding in the years since has added to the lifeless landscape. It's the only since the 1950s that restoration programs were introduced, with much of the mountain below 1,500 meters now hidden by trees once again. Nonetheless, the final few hundred meters to the peak remain like a scene from another planet. Limestone scree from consistent storms and freezing conditions ensure that Ventoux looks like no other mountain to grace the Tour de France. The lack of shelter on the upper slopes can often add an extra cruel twist to the challenge of ascending Ventoux. There's always like amazing like fog cover, cloud covers there. The wind is ridiculous up there. You can get some major gusts of wind, and it just changes everything. So here you go, you're doing great, and you just poke out of the trees, and then you hit that open exposure, and all of a sudden you've got two hills to climb, both Ventoux and a headwind to go along with it. And while it only is 7.43%, I say only and very loosely, there are several sections of the ascent which are dramatically different. So it will have other first 5 kilometers is just under 6%. Brief reprieve at kilometer 6, it drops down to 3.1%. The average slope for the next 9 kilometers is relentless, between 8.6 and 10.5%. Yeah, that's leg-breaking stuff right there. Add to that the wind, add to that the weather, and the weather can be anything, you never know. And the open exposure and nature of Ventoux makes Ventoux what Ventoux is. And so anyway, it's back. We're gonna have a finish on top of Ventoux this year for 2025 coming up. So it'll be fun, but there's great folklore to it. There's wonderful stories of different champions along the years that have done really well there. You go Louison, Bobet, and Tom Simpson. He actually ended up dying on the upper slopes in 1967. He collapsed twice after being dropped by the lead group on stage 13 of the 54th edition of the race. He was pronounced dead by the time he was airlifted off the mountain. It's a crushing place. And there's a big monument on Ventoux. So if you ever get a chance to go to France and ride up Ventoux, you can go to the monument. And it's very impressive. It's a very, very cool thing. A lot of times you'll see Tour de France riders go by and they'll actually salute to the monument as they pass the monument as they're climbing the hill. In 1970, Eddie Merckx powered past a monument erected in Simpson's honor on his way to victory at the summit. Yet perhaps one of the biggest testaments of Mount Ventoux's status was that the Belgian had to be given oxygen in an ambulance after the finish, uttering, "No, it's impossible," as he crossed the line. The cannibal said that. Yeah, Yeah. So there's just all sorts of history to it. It's an amazing climb. Chris Froome, Thomas de Gendt, Richie Porte, you know, all these big time champions over the years have conquered it and have history with it. So it's kind of a neat thing. So check out Mount Ventoux. Google it up, take a look at it, see what it looks like at the top, see if it's something that you want to do. Probably not, but you never know. People go to France to ride different places. We're going to finish this up now. So that's my little piece on Mount Ventoux. And we will move on to a little bit more here just to finish up. It is the wrapping up of cyclocross season. We're getting into our events page here. We do have the national champions coming up on December 12th in Louisville. So it's back to Louisville again. It's been in Louisville a few other times. There was that time with the flood. That was a good time. And then other various times. It's a very welcoming city for cyclists, and it's kind of getting known as kind of a mecca of cycling because of that. So it's pretty cool. And there last year in 2023. So back to Louisville. We'll see what happens there. It could be another great nationals. I'm looking forward to watching it online because I am not going to it. The Project Mayhem Cyclocross Series still has two races left. And I have them here somewhere. Here we go. We have on November 17th coming up in Wallingford, Connecticut, and December 1st in Guilford, Connecticut. And last weekend was Treehouse Cyclocross up in Massachusetts. That's always a big event, always a big spectacular production. So that's cool. So we still have cross racing going on here in New England, and they'll continue. So finishing points. I didn't get to the election part, so I'll cover that again next week, and we'll talk a little bit more about what is still positive as far as transportation funding goes and cycling goes. So I'm going to have to pass on that part right now, but we will get to it next week. And Tadej Pogačar and that impressive contract. How about that, huh? Whew! And so how has your 2024 been? More miles, ride and commute to work or around town, better fitness? Or were you simply out enjoying the rides you take more by slowing down and smelling the roses? I'm going to say it again. It won't be my last time. Get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, the price of gas, and the lack of places to safely ride your bicycle and, you know, do something about it. Go there with solutions, not with problems. And take the Pedal and Run Challenge. Park your car or truck one day and ride your bicycle instead. You just might surprise yourself. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch.
Yo.
And if you're watching on Facebook Live, feel free to comment. You can send me an email to bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, or now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. If you want to contribute information, drop me an email. This is Pedal and Ron. Remember, keep that rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. Save mine. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week. Get on your bikes and ride!